counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice, representing the individual defendant in this case, Daniel Mulholland. And with me at counsel table, I have Chris Hall and Deanna Durrett, the trial counsel in the case. Mr. Mulholland is the former director of the Congressional Research Service, an agency that is charged by statute with fulfilling a unique role to Congress, providing it with objective, balanced, and nonpartisan research and analysis. And he is being sued here and is facing the prospect of personal liability because he terminated the plaintiff's probationary employment in his position as a high-level CRS official after the plaintiff published two articles in national press sharply criticizing the Attorney General's position on Guantanamo detention, Guantanamo detainees being prosecuted by military commission, and the position of the former Attorney General and a Vice President of the United States. I think a reasonable official in Mr. Mulholland's position could certainly conclude that those publications cast sufficient doubt on the plaintiff's ability to effectively serve as a high-level CRS official, to serve as an example of compliance among his staff on the CRS policy on outside speaking and writing, and to serve with the discretion and judgment that was required in that position.
Based on the allegations in the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor, as well as obviously the documents.
But the allegations in the complaint aren't consistent with what you've just argued.
I don't believe that's right, Your Honor. Obviously, to the extent the allegations in the complaint are not supported by well-pleaded factual allegations, they are speculative and don't need to be credited by this court under Iqbal.
But which do you think are speculative?
I would say, for example, the assertion that the allegations had no relationship to the plaintiff's official duties. Obviously.
And what was his job title at that point?
He was the assistant director at CRS. He was the head of one of five research.
What was the division that he had there?
Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade, Your Honor.
Right, thank you.
Right, so his division was responsible for foreign affairs and defense policy. He was responsible for maintaining a continuous liaison with congressional committees with jurisdiction over those areas. Obviously, although he alleges he didn't have direct responsibility for military commissions, there is an obvious overlap between his official duties and the relevant constituents that would be responsible for that matter.
Excuse me, go ahead.
In considering whether the allegations of the complaint are speculative, as you argue, what are we to do with Amici's brief? You make no reference to it in your reply brief.
We don't, Your Honor. Obviously,
Amici suggests a relationship between the Congressional Research Service and Congress that is not inconsistent with the allegations of the complaint in terms of whether speaking as an individual on personal time using your personal computer consistent with the regulations and policy of the employer, that there's no evidence that any congressperson has ever indicated that this was somehow undermining the role of the Congressional Research Service.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, obviously to the extent amici are attempting to inject factual allegations into
You were just arguing framework. That the allegations of the complaint are speculative, and yet the allegations, at least according to the amici brief, have some basis in fact. I mean, we're at this 12B6 stage of the case.
We are, Your Honor, but I think the amici brief point out, for example, that they simply disagree with the CRS policy on outside and speaking and writing. They have a position about how CRS ought to work, what the agency's policies ought to be, that is simply not consistent with the actual policy of the
what
agency.
What about the regulation and the policy encouraging employees to do this outside speaking?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the Library of Congress regulation itself, which applies to all library employees, also recognizes that speech can be inconsistent with an employee's obligation to maintain his or her objectivity and balance. The speech policy of the Library of Congress requires an explicit disclaimer on any publications, and it is undisputed that that was violated here.
There was no disclaimer used.
There was no disclaimer at all, Your Honor. And of course, the Library of Congress regulation applies broadly to library employees, but we are also dealing with here with a component of the library that has a really unique mission and mandate from Congress. And I think one needs also to look at the CRS policy on outside speaking and writing, which reflects what is really a heightened obligation on the part of CRS employees to protect.
Don't want to take, yes, I do. First, I don't want to take you off your plan pace, but actually I want to. Yes. Your second line of defense seemed to me to obviate the necessity for a lot of the problems that are being discussed under the first line. Is there a Bivens remedy at all here?
Well,
if there's no Bivens remedy, then they're out of court, aren't they?
That's right, Your Honor, and that certainly could be a
I'm not sure why you ordered the brief as you did or ordered the oral argument as you did, but isn't that where your first line of defense ought to be, that there just isn't a Bivens remedy here?
And that absolutely would dispose of the case, and that would be a potential ground for this court to rule on. We have a statutory scheme that provides a comprehensive remedy for employment actions against federal employees. In that scheme, it is clear that no probationary employee, no employee within his initial one-year period of employment, whether competitive service, accepted service, any class of employee, can find judicial review of the merits of that termination decision. And yet the plaintiff here asks us to assume that Congress nevertheless...
How about persons in his position who are not probationary? Did they have a remedy under CESRA?
They would not, Your Honor, accept potentially as preference eligible, but again, because of his status in the Library of Congress, likely not, no. But I think that reflects, much as the Second Circuit faced in the Dotson v. Grisa case, a circumstance in which Congress intended to really preserve the independence of part of what Congress viewed as an entity with close ties to the legislative branch, rather than put them under the scheme that would apply to executive branch entities.
What are we to make of the ethnic employees holding?
With respect, Your Honor, I think it really doesn't address in any way the issues that are before this court.
I understand, but what I'm getting at is that's been out there a long time. Congress has acted both in the CSRA and the CAA since then. And even in the CAA asked for this study to be done as to whether or not there was a comprehensive scheme vis-a-vis library employees and whether or not it was effective. So isn't that some indication that Congress hasn't spoken as comprehensively as you're suggesting here?
Well, if I may just start with the ethnic employees case. Obviously, the claims there involved in part alleged harm done to the employee organization itself. So I think there's no suggestion that the recognition or non-recognition of an employee organization would come within a scheme that is about adverse employment actions. And obviously, no one was arguing for CSRA preclusion in that case. I think the issue before the court was quite narrow. I think this court...
It was talking about whether or not these constitutional claims, were barred since there was Title VII relief available, and the court said no. And, the Supreme Court in Koenig making these distinctions between claims, and that's all I'm asking.
Right, although I think the court was clear that many of the harms alleged, for example, the retaliation for speech against the employee organization and members of the organization, would not have been covered or even envisioned by Congress to be covered under Title VII.
Well, the holding sentence is repeated twice, and it's very broad. That's all I'm getting at.
Right. I think it needs to be read in context, and certainly in the context of this court's subsequent decisions on CSRA preclusion, I think Spaniola makes very clear that the fact that an employee, for example, may not have a remedy under the scheme is not dispositive. We really need to look at what Congress would have intended. And I think, as this court made clear in Wilson v. Libby, where Congress has clearly chosen not to provide a remedy, and here the remedy would be a right of judicial review of the merits of termination of probationary employment, it is particularly in that context where it would be inappropriate for a court to exercise its federal common law authority to create such a remedy.
As you point out in your brief, he's not left without a remedy because of the injunctive relief.
That's exactly
that can be
right,
sought against the Library of Congress. Are you saying by that that since Billington is sued in his official capacity, that you're not challenging the litigation going forward against, I know that's not before us, but against Billington in his official capacity for injunctive relief?
We obviously will be defending against that suit. We think ultimately there was no violation here, but we have acknowledged and conceded in the district court that he has a valid claim for injunctive relief under this court's decisions in Spaniola, among others, recognizing that even where CSRA preclusion applies, an employee may still have a valid injunctive claim against the agency itself.
Okay.
Right. If this court has no further questions, we'll reserve for rebuttal.
Okay, we'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. Aiden Fine on behalf of the plaintiff, Morris Davis. Mm-hmm. Colonel Davis was fired from his job for writing an op-ed and a letter to the editor about a subject of immense public concern. That speech is exactly the kind of speech by government employees that the First Amendment protects. And Colonel Davis is...
But you recognize that government employees have limited First Amendment rights to speak out depending upon their position with the government, right?
They have less First Amendment...
The three of us on this bench can't go out making political statements. We work for the government.
That is correct as a general matter, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But
as a specific matter here, he was the director of a division. What was the name of that division?
Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade. But
and he was writing op-eds attacking attorneys general of both parties about matters that related to foreign affairs and defense, right?
The complaint makes clear that Colonel Davis's division, despite its name,
I didn't ask you that. I asked you if he was not making political statements critical of attorneys general of two parties when he had the directorship of foreign affairs and defense.
He did, Your Honor, and the First Amendment protects his right mm-hmm. to do that unless
that's
the government can show.
That's what we're here about, counsel.
Well, I understand there's also the Bivens issue, and I will.
No, on that issue, you said the First Amendment protects his right to do that. That's what we're here about.
Correct.
Yeah. We haven't decided that.
I understand. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to say is the First Amendment protects his right to do that unless the government can show that the harm to its operations.
DRS policy says because almost everything that the staff write or say has the potential to be controversial, it's important to err on the side of caution with reference to the policy on public statements, right?
Correct. And it does not...
You think that this looks like somebody who erred on the side of caution? I mean, even given the best light to this...
I do think so, Your Honor. If you look at the op-ed, there are two pieces here. There's the op-ed and there's the letter to the editor. The op-ed is a pure statement of Colonel Davis's personal beliefs and personal views about whether...
Did he put a disclaimer in there?
Colonel Davis was previously specifically advised, and the complaint makes this clear, there's
no disclaimer.
Did he put
a disclaimer in there?
There's no disclaimer in there.
Did the policies call for a disclaimer, specifically call for a disclaimer?
The policies say that when your official duties are at issue and when there's any chance, you should explicitly dissociate yourself.
Did he put a disclaimer in?
There is not a disclaimer in these particular pieces.
That would be a no, right?
That is a no.
Right.
He was previously advised by a CRS attorney that he didn't need to put an express disclaimer in so long as there was no association made between the writing and his job at CRS. Here, these writings refer solely to his former job as the chief prosecutor at Guantanamo. They have nothing to do with his CRS responsibilities. The complaint makes that clear. Counsel says that the complaint's allegations are speculative. They're nothing but fact-based. This complaint specifically alleges, paragraphs 29 through 32, that a separate division at CRS, the American Law Division, had sole responsibility for Guantanamo Military Commission's issues. The ALD division is the one who wrote all the reports, signed all their names, in the CRS subject matter directory, which is what Congress looks at when they need to call somebody over at CRS.
Well, the government's argument, though, in part, isn't it that, you know, a person in Mr. Mulholland's position could decide that these two publications just went too far. It's one thing to speak at a law school. It's another thing to speak in an association dinner. But it's quite a different thing to be in the Washington Post, etc.
That might be a reasonable policy, but that wasn't the library's policy. The library's policy encouraged...
No, but Mr. Mulholland's explanation was, in effect, he had concluded that this was evidence of bad judgment, and therefore there was not a good fit between your client and the research service.
Your Honor,
Colonel, that's obviously a value judgment, and it's a very subjective judgment, but your client is a probationary employee.
Colonel Davis had previously engaged in speech on the exact same subject matter, Guantanamo and military commissions.
No good deed goes unpunished. They let him do it one time, so no good deed goes unpunished.
They let him do it numerous times, Your Honor. They let him do it numerous times. And this court's decision in Keefe makes clear that where speech policies, and this Keefe involved CRS and CRS speech policies, where speech policies do not expressly prohibit speech, and past practice makes clear that speech is permitted, not just by the plaintiff here or by Ms. Keefe in Keefe, but by other CRS employees.
Did he have disclaimers in the others?
He did not, and neither did in the
evidence. Did he have statements about, personal statements about a vice president and two attorneys general?
I'm not sure about every single statement he's ever made, Your Honor, but he certainly criticized both the Bush administration and the Obama administration's decisions with respect to military commissions.
But he's working in an office that's supposed to provide unbiased, nonpartisan advice, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you're telling me he criticized both administrations. It's not supposed to be bipartisan. It's supposed to be nonpartisan. You're admitting he criticized both administrations when he's director of the division.
He criticized their policy choices, Your Honor.
Right.
And
he criticized the motive of Cheney when he referred to it as fear-mongering.
Fear-mongering. It wasn't just policy. It was a personal attack on both administrations.
About our Keefe decision. I don't have it up here with me. I thought I did. But there was a manual back then for new employees that the court quoted from extensively. And it had language in a conversational tone. You know, don't do this, don't do that. Always think about where you're working and so forth. And it ends by saying something like, we are to advise on what is to be done, not what ought to be done. And that's highlighted in the manual. I couldn't find whether that manual is still applicable, but I realized that he was speaking not in his position. That is, he wasn't saying to a member of Congress, this is what ought to be done. But he did violate that policy, if it's still in effect, by saying what ought, in his opinion, what ought to be done. Do you remember that manual?
I don't remember the exact words from that manual, but the operable library policy right now, LRC 2023-3, does not expressly prohibit any speech. And in fact,
about the CRS policy that says it's important that since almost everything CRS staff say or write has the potential to be controversial, it's important to err on the side of caution. How about that?
That's
operative policy right now, right?
Well, there's an actual question which is not before the court here as to whether the CRS policy is itself enforceable under the statute. The Librarian of Congress is the only entity that is able to promulgate regulations for library employees. But leaving that issue aside,
I'd leave that one.
The CRS policy does not state anywhere that any particular speech is prohibited. And in fact, Defendant Mulholland personally approved Colonel Davis's speech on the exact same subject matters, Guantanamo and the military commissions.
I want to move you to the other issue as well, because time is a factor. Is there a Bivens remedy available to him at all?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. This case is different from all of the other statutory preclusion Bivens cases that have been before the Supreme Court or this court. Here, under the allegedly preclusive statutory scheme, CISRA, Library of Congress employees, no Library of Congress employees have any statutory remedies or rights.
Yeah, that's part of your problem. Congress made a comprehensive scheme, and if they omit somebody from a comprehensive scheme, shouldn't we assume Congress knows what it's doing?
Yes.
Congress does not want us out here implying causes of action where they've decided there isn't one.
That would be the case if Congress had actually spoken to claims by Library of Congress employees. There's no evidence in the record at all that Congress actually was thinking about Library of Congress employees in enacting CISRA. In fact, CISRA's remedial scheme, we have to look at the remedial scheme, chapters 23, chapter 43, and chapter 75, have no references to Library of Congress employees. What they're dealing with and what the cases make clear that CISRA was dealing with were executive branch employees, civil service. They're dealing with civil servants in the Merit Systems Protection Act. So merit systems principles do not apply to Library of Congress employees. This is not a situation. Fausto is a good example. Fausto dealt with the statutory claims, so it wasn't dealing with the constitutional claims. But in Fausto, the court focused on language in Chapter 75 saying preference-eligible employees have certain remedies. The plaintiff in Fausto was a non-preference-eligible employee. And so the court said, well, Congress intentionally gave preference-eligible employees a certain remedy, so therefore we can conclude that they didn't intend to give you, plaintiff, a non-preference-eligible employee, a remedy. Here, that is not this case. Congress hasn't said we're going to provide one remedy but not remedy two, and so therefore Congress's failure to provide remedy two can't be said to be inadvertent. Here, Congress didn't say anything about library employees.
But let me ask you, I mean, the government's brief cites various provisions of the CSRA that are applicable.
None in the remedial sections of CISRA. The only references in CISRA that I'm aware of that the government cites in Chapter 71, which is dealing with labor relations, and it gives Library of Congress employees the right to have a collective bargaining agreement.
They gave them that right and not the other one. Who are we to take over and imply a cause of action where Congress has dealt with this area?
Congress has not dealt
sounds
with...
Sounds like the kind of special factors we normally say preclude Bivens.
Congress has not dealt with adverse employment actions with respect to Library of Congress employees. The Chapter 71, the labor relations issues, have nothing at all to do with the situation that's before us here.
Are they accepted employees under CSRA?
The definition of accepted employee in CSRA is essentially anyone who's a non-executive branch employee. Okay? It's
so
broadly defined like that.
So they are.
Arguably, they are. Arguably.
But what I'm getting at is the argument is made in part that they are accepted employees under CSRA, thereby, I don't want to misrepresent the government's position, but thereby implying, or maybe even more strongly, that Congress intended to leave to the librarian regulation of employee rights and remedies.
Well, I don't think that is correct, Your Honor, because we have to look at the remedial scheme here, and there's absolutely no reference to library employees. And so this isn't a situation where the court can say Congress has made a choice here. Congress hasn't evinced any choice one way or the other here. And because there's no statutory remedy, the rationale underlying the other statutory preclusion cases is simply not present here. This is not a case where the plaintiff is coming to the court like in Bush.
Yeah, but we expressly said that it doesn't matter that the particular plaintiff doesn't have a remedy.
When
that does not preclude preclusion.
That is correct, Your Honor, with respect to plaintiffs who are included within the comprehensive remedial scheme. And that's the key point here, and that's what Spagnola focuses on.
That's not what Wilson v. Libby said. I mean, Joe Wilson was left without any remedy. And his claim was he was outrageously slimed, and for something he wrote in, I think it was the New York Times, wherever it was, and we said he had no remedy. And does this plaintiff have, considering that he has a lessened First Amendment right because he's a government employee, are we going to give him more than we gave Joe Wilson?
The Wilson case would have been similar to this one if the only plaintiff there had been Joe Wilson. He wasn't the only plaintiff. And the court focused on the fact that
his own Privacy Act claim.
Well, the court's decision put those two Privacy Act claims together because the harm was from one disclosure.
That Wilson was left with no remedy under the Privacy Act.
Period.
That is correct. However,
that was a First Amendment claim.
It was. However, the court held that the plaintiffs themselves had a statutory remedy, and that was key. Here, the plaintiff has no statutory remedy. And so under Spagnuolo focuses on the outer boundaries of a comprehensive scheme and focuses on, is the plaintiff within those outer boundaries? And Spagnuolo makes clear that in some situations is, quote, less than clear. This is that situation. Here in Spagnuolo, the plaintiffs had very limited remedies. And the court held, even though those remedies were very limited, they had something. So therefore, they were included within the comprehensive scheme. And the court said that therefore, CISRA technically accommodates their claims. Here, CISRA does not provide Colonel Davis with anything. It can't even be said to technically accommodate his claims. The court's decision, the Supreme Court's decision.
Let me just pursue that so I'm clear. There are collective bargaining rights provided
to some library employees. Colonel Davis?
I was going to ask you, is his status as an assistant director, does that take him out of the category?
That is correct, Your Honor. And so if Congress intended to provide library employees with rights through this,
they would have done so.
They would have done so through the CBA.
They didn't do so.
But with respect to Colonel Davis and similar people who weren't subject to those CBA rights, that would have clearly been an inadvertent decision.
Your time is up unless my colleagues have
further questions. I've got a couple questions. Okay. Well, then what do you hope to gain with your claim for injunctive relief against Billington? I mean, that is relief.
Yes, Your Honor. But there has never been the potential availability of injunctive relief has never been held to be a ground to preclude a Bivens action. If that were the case, Spagnuolo itself wouldn't have had to have been decided. In Spagnuolo, as in this case, as in Chaliki itself, the plaintiffs asked for both Bivens damages and for equitable relief. If the mere availability of injunctive relief had been sufficient, that would have ended the discussion, period. And counsel has represented that the defendant Mulholland has conceded the availability of injunctive relief in this case. That's not correct at all. They've conceded that the court has authority to hear those claims, but there's a serious question as to whether Colonel Davis will actually be entitled to back pay because of the court's decision in Fausto. That's an open issue, and the government has been very careful never to concede that even if he were to prevail, even if Colonel Davis prevailed on the merits, it's unclear whether he'll actually be able to get anything. So the mere availability of potential injunctive relief cannot be deemed to be a special factor counseling hesitation.
Okay. I had one other question. That is, I do have Keith in front of me now. It was a manual for new employees by someone named C. Goodrum, Your Work in the Congressional Research Service, an introductory operating manual. And it says, we must retain the respect of all members on all sides of an issue. We work equally for all congressmen and senators, their staff and committee staff, and all must have confidence that when you assist them, you do so with your knowledge of the field, not from your convictions of what ought to be done, which is precisely the focus of these.
And I think that's an accurate representation of what a CRS employee's job, is. When Colonel Davis wrote the op-ed and the letter to the editor, he wasn't writing in his capacity as a CRS employee. He was writing in his capacity as a private citizen, and that's why, unless the government can show harm, which we don't believe they can, based on the allegations in the complaint, that's why we believe his First Amendment rights were protected.
Any further questions? If not, then does the government wish to be heard in rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel. She has time left.
Ms. Swingle, do you know if that manual is still in effect? I couldn't.
I do not know, Your Honor, but I will say that the description in the manual is fully consistent with the policy of CRS that's set out in its own speech policy and the animating concerns that I think are reflected in Mr. Mulholland's memorandum of admonishment, et cetera. I think even if a CRS employee might not be categorically barred under the policy from engaging in speech of this nature, the director could certainly view that it doesn't comply with the urging to err on the side of caution, that it doesn't comply with the urging to submit a piece for pre-publication review, that it casts doubt on his judgment, his discretion. All of those are entirely legitimate reasons to think that somebody who is in a probationary period of employment as a very high-level agency official should not be converted to permanent status.
Is that the key here to the government's argument, that he was a probationary employee?
Well, I don't think it's dispositive, obviously.
Well, what I'm thinking, I can think of all kinds of hypotheticals where CSR employees on their own time make controversial statements. And I don't read the government's brief to go so far as to say they could be fired for that.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think the key is this was a course of conduct that cast real doubt on his judgment and
he didn't put in the disclaimer that the policy
He didn't put in the disclaimer required. Exactly when he was counseled.
And he made that attack on the persons of the fearmongers.
It had an intentionally provocative tone.
Yeah.
When he didn't tell his supervisor about it in advance, when his supervisor found out about it and expressed concern, he in no way acknowledged that this could harm his effectiveness in his role. And I think all of those were legitimate concerns for a supervisor who was facing a situation in which his employee was about to convert to permanent status, might feel he could permissively take action. If I may come just...
Can I just ask just one other thing? To the extent when you read the letter of notice of termination, you have to wonder why he was ever hired in the first place, given he had taken a very public position criticizing two administrations on the handling of certain types of national security issues. And obviously, these were matters that Congress was from time to time considering. That's the disjunct in this case for me, and that's why I'm trying to understand how on 12b-6, as distinct from after the government could offer evidence showing that indeed there were problems, a supervisor just decides, you know, I made a mistake, in effect. And because this is a probationary employee, you know, I'm at liberty to do pretty much whatever I want in terms of firing him.
If I may say two things, Your Honor. I think the first is, obviously, CRS did have a policy that set out its view about outside speaking and writing. And while not disabling candidates because of prior speech, I mean, obviously, the agency did look for subject matter experts. It would be unrealistic to think that people had never spoken or written publicly. I think the agency could reasonably assume that once people were hired, particularly into high-level positions, that they would, in fact, comply with the CRS policy. Second, I think there is nothing in this record that would show or suggest that the content and tone of his public speaking before his employment was comparable to what was really some very intemperate language in at least the letter to the editor here. I know my time is up. If I can just respond.
Any further questions from my colleagues?
I will ask the court to reverse.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your
Honor. Case is submitted. Call the next case.